You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, reclaiming Hinduism from the secular. Our Women of Faith series continues. But first, to developments in Asia, where we're watching the aftermath of a surprise meeting between President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, and in Hong Kong, where protesters are marching over concerns about their civil liberties. We're turning to two guests. Ankit Panda is with us. He's an adjunct senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists and with us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Ankit. Welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sheila Smith is with us, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's with us from Washington. And Sheila, welcome to you. Good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Sheila, President Trump spent 50 minutes with Kim Jong-un. And my question is this an indication that the North Korean dictator wants a deal, or is it an indication that the North Korean dictator likes the spectacle of being on international television with an American president?
It's a great question. It's hard to know what Kim Jong-un wants, but I'll tell you what my impression is from watching this. This is the third Trump-Kim summit. The last one, as you know, was in Hanoi, and it broke off when President Trump said, you know, there was no way forward to a deal, and he was calling off the conversation. So it's clear to me that Kim Jong-un wanted to get back in to a conversation with the United States, which gives me a little bit of hope that there is something there at the working level once we get some time and some expertise behind this latest round. But I don't know. I think the spectacle is also appealing to our president, to be quite honest. I was watching him and Kim and John looking an awful lot like President Moon and Chairman Kim more than a year ago. It was the same setting, the same theatrics. And clearly the president wanted that kind of impact.
President Moon of South Korea, you're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Ankit, is there... I mean, is there enough for a serious restart to talks, or what do you see is the purpose of this meeting that took place a couple days ago?
Well, so, I mean, looking at most of the diplomacy that's been going on since the process began in 2018, really in March 2018, when the Singapore summit was first announced, we've been going around in circles. This is not the first time that a working group between the two sides has convened since last year. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had working level talks in Pyongyang at least twice last year, both times leading to an eventual collapse. Steve Biegun, the special representative on North Korea policy, who's now been presumably empowered by the president to continue talks with Choi Sun-hee, a North Korean diplomat with decades of experience talking to Americans, has also been in working level talks. So that is the big outcome here. I'm just not convinced that we have evidence that the fundamental negotiating positions have changed in a way that would render the working level talks more useful than they were in the past. Until that happens, I think we're really not going to see a change. But I think for Kim Jong-un, the purpose of this meeting was really to continue to demonstrate that the personal relationship between him and President Trump continues to be positive. In April, right after the Hanoi summit, Kim Jong-un delivered public remarks in North Korea when he said that while the relationship between North Korea and the United States remains difficult, the relationship between him and President Trump is quite positive.
But what's the, towards what end, though? Okay, so they're friendlier than the dictator has been with other American presidents. And that gets us what?
Well, so that's, I think that's exactly the issue. It appears to have gotten us very little apart from successive summits between the two leaders. We still have no agreement with North Korea on anything related to disarmament that is more specific than the very vague agreement that was signed by the two men in Singapore. So President Trump continues to obviously benefit from the pageantry and from the positive media coverage. I think for him, he really sees this as one of the signature issues that his administration can talk up as a success. But really, we're no closer to dealing with the nagging problem of North Korea's ballistic missiles and nuclear arsenal.
Sheila, the other thing I wondered about is whether you think that President Trump and his team have a better understanding of who the North Koreans are and what they want, because they've been in these rooms and spaces three times. I mean, is there something to be said for, we've looked them in the eye, we've had these meetings, terms are friendlier, we get them in a way that other administrations haven't?
Well, I mean,
I think you'd hope so.
I was asking Sheila about that. Go ahead, Sheila.
Oh, sorry. So I think the one-on-one does give us a window. And again, you know, the president is not in the room alone, although he is often not with many advisors in the room with him. But what I think we've also seen is not just in the president's interaction with Kim Jong-un, but in Kim Jong-un's interaction with Xi Jinping, with Vladimir Putin up in Vladivostok not that long ago, and with Moon himself, we've had an awful lot of opportunity to witness Kim Jong-un in action. And that's a new piece of this attempt to negotiate with the DPRK, with North Korea. I do think here that, you know, the top-down approach, leaving aside the style issues of our president, the top-down approach is a new approach. Therefore, it's worth pursuing and worth trying to tap into. You know, Kim Jong-un will make decisions and is the person who can make decisions on the North Korean side. And so why not see what decisions he's ready to make? All that being said, however, I am not convinced that this approach has rendered anything different, right, in terms of are we more knowledgeable about their willingness to denuclearize? No, we're not. We're certainly not further along than we were 18 months ago. So had we had some traction and some results from this approach, I might be a little bit more willing to say that this is you know, going to be a positive outcome. But here's two pieces of the puzzle that I'm a little worried about. Mm-hmm. One is the disarray in the Trump administration itself. And you can see this movement with Secretary of State Pompeo and the National Security Advisor Bolton. You know, Special Representative Baker is clearly the one who's messaging what the United States would like to accomplish in working level talks. But the principles at the top of our government are being sidelined by the president, brought back into the conversation by the president. It's very hard to chart a path forward in a consistent kind of way with that kind of volatility at the top. The second point I think we have to talk about, and I'll just briefly mention it, we can talk more if you'd like, but is the impact on the region, especially on our allies. I just wrote a piece this morning about my concerns about Seoul and Tokyo's relationship. The North Korea negotiations are always difficult for our allies because they're slightly, there are different interests at stake here. But this is a negotiation that we're not just doing on behalf of ourselves, but we're also doing it on behalf of two non-nuclear powers in Northeast Asia. And we have to remember that they need to be part of the conversation and their interests well represented.
So, Anki, to those two things that Sheila is concerned about, first, the volatility within the Trump administration itself. Are you watching who's making decisions and how the president is taking that into these conversations with Chairman Kim and worried about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the North Koreans are also doing a bit of criminology, so to speak, about the American political system. One of the most, you know, I read North Korean propaganda day in and day out to try and better understand their intentions. And one of the most interesting things to observe over the last year is how astute the North Koreans have been about separating President Trump from his advisors, who tend to be more hawkish on the issue of negotiations with North Korea. And here I would point out men like National Security Advisor John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The two men have been called out by name in North Korean statements in April. Basically, the North Koreans have said that they have very little interest in talking to Pompeo and Bolton. But President Trump continues to receive lavish praise in North Korean state media. So the North Koreans have really made a bet that President Trump's unconventional style of negotiating and really his unconventional style of managing his own administration and dealing with his own deputies is what the North Koreans can really count on to win what they've really been seeking now for several years, which is sanctions relief. Mm. I do think the North Koreans miscalculated on that behalf in Hanoi, right? Because I think they expected to walk into that summit and really walk away with a result like Singapore, where President Trump was not only willing to sign an agreement with Kim Jong-un that was really using language that the two countries had finessed over 25 years of diplomacy. But also, President Trump unilaterally agreed to, you know, cancel planned military exercises. And this goes to Sheila's second point about the effect on our allies. Of course, I think the miscalculation in Hanoi has now led the North Koreans to regroup and recalibrate, leading to this third summit. So going forward, I think the North Koreans will continue to really rely on President Trump to move this process forward. But as we saw in Hanoi, it's no guarantee that it will work.
And Sheila, you are concerned about how whatever the president is saying or agreeing to or open to is going to reflect back on South Korea and Japan and others. And is the concern that the president might step too deeply into some kind of we fell in love deal that does not represent well in the region, as in he'll give things away. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Now, I think, you know, we have to also recognize that, you know, this is our third round of serious attempts to engage North Korea in a denuclearization dialogue, right? So we've been here before, as in, you know, we've got a deep institutional history of trying to proceed with denuclearization with North Korea. And each time it's revealed different points of view in Seoul and in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And so there is slightly different interests here. But at the very bottom line is we have two alliances in which non-nuclear powers depend on us to make sure that to deter nuclear, right, aggression against them or any kind of aggression against them. And so as Anki referenced earlier, when President Trump came out of the Singapore summit, and began to speak in a language that North Korea typically uses about provocative war games to describe what is regularly planned exercises that maintain the readiness of our troops on the Korean Peninsula, it was worrisome. Now, the South Korean government wants to see negotiations move forward, so they were not overtly going to criticize that outcome. The Japanese were very careful not to criticize what the president was saying about South Korea, but they publicly restated that these kinds of exercises are critically important, not only for making sure that their forces are ready in case something happens, but also in communicating the U.S. willingness, right, to continue to deter and, if necessary, defend our allies. So there's the military piece, and that's an important one. The negotiations beyond that, of course, will ultimately sort of test a little bit the sanctions regime, which Prime Minister Abe has been very, very strong on maintaining. A very tight-knit international coalition imposing pretty critical sanctions, economic sanctions on North Korea in order to get them to the bargaining table. President Moon would like to relax those sanctions just a little bit to see what kind of negotiations might come out of that. So there will be a kind of difficulty here in how the U.S. moves forward with sequencing or pacing the denuclearization talks themselves. All that being said, this is not a time to be unpredictable. This is not a time to not make sure that our allies understand our strategy and also that they are willing to go along when we are ready and if there's a moment where compromise is needed in the negotiating process.
Sheila Smith is with us. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Ankit Panda is with us, an adjunct senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, and he specializes in Asia and nuclear force there. We've asked them both to come join us this morning to give us some insight and clarity on what this latest meeting between President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un means, and then what policy flows, if any, flows out of this, and how this sets up if there is to be another summit between the leaders and continued conversation between the two countries. If you have a question about this, 651-227-6000. Think we could squeeze a couple in. 800-242-2828. You can also tweet me at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, N-P-R. Anki, question, does anybody inside the Trump administration really believe that in the end North Korea is going to give up their nuclear capability?
Well, certainly John Bolton continues to speak as if that is a likely outcome. Although I think the implication there is that Bolton, I think, has been on the record before he was National Security Advisor as supporting effectively military action against North Korea and not diplomacy. So allowing diplomacy to run its course and possibly fail would actually end up fulfilling that objective in a perverse way. But Look, I mean, throughout this process, North Korea has never actually offered to disarm itself unilaterally of its nuclear weapons. There's that term at the center of all diplomacy with North Korea since really 1992, which is the word denuclearization. And we use it sort of without a second thought. And a lot of times it's presumed to just mean that North Korea will give up its nuclear weapons. But that term, especially in the Korean Peninsula context, has a very particular meaning. And the North Koreans, I think, really appreciate that meaning and that history. And it's not clear at all to me that the American negotiators have appreciated that history, or at least in their public remarks, they don't show themselves to be necessarily aware of what that means.
Well,
and I'll just describe that a little bit more.
Yeah, do, please.
Because for the North Koreans, in 1992, the two Koreas, for the first time in January that year, signed an agreement on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And in 1992, North Korea didn't have a nuclear weapons capability. It was working on one. South Korea, meanwhile, had just been host to U.S. tactical nuclear weapons between 1958 and 1991. So the balance on the Korean Peninsula was rather different. And the North Koreans had looked at these tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea and really had an interest in getting rid of them. They were a major threat to their own security at the time. So the two Koreas, when they agreed to denuclearize back then, did so under a very different set of circumstances. And that fundamental framing, I think, is still what we are talking about today. It's about both sides taking reciprocal steps. Of course, U.S. tactical nuclear weapons haven't been on the Korean Peninsula since 1991, but the North Koreans still don't acknowledge that. And what the North Koreans are really looking for from our side of the ledger is for steps related to our alliance with South Korea, our military posture in East Asia more broadly, including in Japan and Guam. The North Koreans repeatedly talk about the United States needing to remove, quote, the nuclear threat from North Korea. Mm-hmm. So these issues have really been left out of the ongoing round of diplomacy, and it's not at all clear to me that the U.S. side is either interested or aware of these issues.
Take a call here from Mark in St. Paul. Hi, Mark. What are you curious about?
Hi. As a comment, since it's so clear that the North Koreans pay such close attention to our political situation and to Donald Trump in particular, I'm just curious. It's obvious that Bolton and the advisors are aware that they're manipulating Mr. Trump with the letters and whatnot, but I just wonder if President Trump himself is aware that he's being manipulated by these people.
Sheila?
Great question, Mark. I don't know. I don't know. I do think when you watch from the outside, the president has been very sensitive about advisors and aides that have gotten out of step with him. And you can see that, not specific to the North Korea problem, but you could see it throughout the 2.5, almost 3 years now that we've had the Trump presidency. You know, we've gone through the Secretary of Defense. We've gone through we're in our second Secretary of State. We're on our third, maybe fourth, I can't remember now, National Security Advisor. So I think this is a president who is very jealous of his own ability to make decisions. And again, it goes hand in hand. That sensitivity also plays out when he wants to be engaged on these one-on-one initiatives that are really what he sees as kind of breakthrough attempts to create a legacy for himself. Now, I don't want to undermine the possibilities that the one-on-one with Kim Jong-un could produce a positive outcome. I'm not a Pollyannish kind of optimist on that score, but I do think it's worth a good shot. The problem here is if the president doesn't allow experts and his aides and team to set up a successful working-level process, then all of the breakthroughs that he makes on his own initiative on these, you know, very unorthodox kinds of approaches to North Korea, all of that will be for nothing. And that's where I worry, again, that we don't have a good synchronization between the style of the president in this negotiation and the absolutely crucial kind of knowledge that you need going into a working group effort. This is not easy. It's never been easy. And as Anki pointed out, the sophistication of the North Koreans in trying to deploy their capabilities, first of all, to demonstrate to us what they've got, but also to, I think, Kim Jong-un, going back to your very original question, I think he's learning that he has some latitude to try to use the president's penchant for this kind of photo op pageantry, whatever the right word is, I think Kim Jong-un has learned that this works. So we have to be very skeptical, and we have to hold him to account, and you can only do that if your experts are in the room and doing what they do well and best, and that requires a certain amount of unity in Trump's team.
Sheila Smith is with us, if you've just gotten in on the discussion, from the Council on Foreign Relations, and Ankit Pandey is with us from the Federation of American Scientists. Ankit, Russia and China are on the record this morning publicly urging Iran to show restraint. If you're Iran and you're watching the way this is unfolding between the U.S. and North Korea, what kinds of, I don't know, lessons or strategies are you taking away from this?
Well, I mean, the news on that front isn't very good, right? Because if I am Iran and I'm watching the pageantry with Kim Jong-un go down, I see that nuclear weapons really have immense value in statecraft, especially for weaker countries in dealing with their irrepressibly hostile superpower adversaries. I think that's really the core lesson. Of course, that's incredibly troubling for decades of U.S. non-proliferation policy. And we have statements on the record, really, from I think the best one comes from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who asked about the two countries, really just said on the record that he that the United States was dealing with North Korea differently because the country had nuclear weapons.
So he
that's really the core lesson.
He has publicly stated that.
Yes, in an interview in a response to a question. He literally said that North Korea has nuclear weapons, so we're treating them differently.
And so I think where you were going with this was, if you're Iran, what's the downside of, you know, moving into having nuclear weapons? I mean, maybe you're going to be treated more seriously than to be part of this deal.
Yeah, I mean, I still think Iran's best option is to remain in compliance with the JCPOA, which they unfortunately appear to now be drifting away from under the guise of seeking leverage against the remaining countries in that agreement. But, you know, there are some key differences here in that by the time President Trump came about and the current round of diplomacy with North Korea kicked off, North Korea had really already almost fully flourished as a nuclear power. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. It doesn't even have a political decision right now to create nuclear weapons. So between that decision happening and Iran actually getting to the point where North Korea is today, where it necessarily, you know, does command a degree of leverage in these talks, a lot could happen, including a possible military conflict between the United States and Iran. So it's not clear to me that the Iranians are looking at this and saying, let's break out immediately. But I think they may be looking at the decisions that they made in 2003, which is the last time that they were conducting work on weaponizing a nuclear device, and possibly having some regrets about the path that they chose going forward.
Sheila, is this another moment when we talk about Iran and what they're seeing with what's happening with North Korea, where you come back to this volatility within the administration and you kind of worry about what that means?
I do, and I think Secretary Bolton has had a long-standing position on the JCPOA and on Iran, and, you know, we can call him a hardliner. I worry that we're not really taking a step back from these two cases of proliferation or potential proliferation in one case and actual proliferation in the other. What this does is it raises serious questions about American commitment to supporting nonproliferation, right? Both in through the United Nations, but also in our own individual relationships with these countries. It raises questions, again, as I said earlier, about our willingness to extend nuclear deterrence to countries who don't want to move in that direction. But I think we are looking at a moment here where, if I felt like our administration had a longer-term strategy for how to deal with the problem of proliferation, not just a case-by-case, you know, treatment of North Korea and a case-by-case treatment of Iran, or a case-by-case approach that was so based on personal preference and very unpredictable kinds of indicators of what constituted success, right? This is, for me, I worry what we see in the Trump administration here is not a long-term strategy for how to make America safer, but rather a kind of attempt to really marshal American authority over countries where we have some disagreement or disgruntlement. That we should treat North Korea and Iran as different problems, to me, doesn't make much sense.
Sheila, thank you much. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
You're welcome.
Sheila Smith is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ankit, I just have one question here about Hong Kong. What's the end game for the protesters?
Hong Kong is really, I think, a sad tale right now. For the protesters, the attempt here is to stave off the inevitable, which is the complete breakdown of the one country, two systems pledge that China had given the people of Hong Kong for at least 50 years after the handover in 1997. I think the people of Hong Kong have seen their freedoms become eroded and indistinguishable from those of mainland China much quicker than they ever expected to. And I think that's really been what's been driving this recent round of protests over the extradition bill and other issues. So really the attempt here is to postpone the continuing erosion of these freedoms and hope that over the course of that, Hong Kong will retain its unique identity for a little bit longer. But I really think that this there is a deep sense of sorrow in the city about what the Chinese Communist Party has really done to Hong Kong over the last 2 decades, and certainly in the last 5 years.
And if you are the Communist Party, I mean, yes, that decision about extradition for now was tabled. But what have you taken away from this?
Well, so the Communist Party, I think, likely has faced a degree of international embarrassment on this. Hong Kong is, in many ways, the portal that China has long had to the international economy. It's a city that's heavy with expats. It has a free press, including major international news agencies that have been covering the process day in and day out. It's certainly been a page one news story for many days in the month of June and probably in the month of July, given the rate at which things are continuing. So for the Communist Party, you know, one would like to think that the protesters are successful in sending their message that these kinds of heavy-handed tactics to assimilate Hong Kong into the mainland are not going to be tolerated. But on the other hand, you know, we just passed the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre, of course. And I'm not suggesting that something like that might happen again in China. China is a very different place today. And even the leadership, while it does continue to tolerate brutality in certain aspects of its internal rule, it may see that the protests in Hong Kong are a symptom that the approach that Beijing has taken so far has been insufficiently heavy-handed. And we may, in fact, enter a period now in Hong Kong where, you know, no matter of protest will really be able to push back against what the Communist Party has always wanted to do to the cities. So that's, of course, I think, the worst-case outcome here for the protest. I do think that at least over the last 2 weeks, it did look like the protesters have had a degree of success in getting the extradition bill withdrawn, temporarily at least. But broadly speaking, I think many of these protesters are aware of the fact that the trajectory that Hong Kong continues to be on is not a positive one.
Ankit, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back. Really enjoyed the discussion.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.